is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. Inch by inch, row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sow. Someone warmed them from below till the rain come tumbling down.
That's right, folks. Inch by inch, row by row. Welcome to another, the fourth season of Growing a Greener Kenai right here on KDLL 91.9 FM in Kenai and Soldotna. You heard me say that a little bit ago. I'm so happy to be back for the fourth season of Growing a Greener Kenai. And we've got two guests today. But before I get into that, I want to do a quick weather report. We got, it looks like all week, it looks like we're going to be stuck with rain and snow all week, at least through Friday. We got chance of rain and chance of rain and snow coming up on Monday night. It says chance of precipitation, 70%, all snow after 4 a.m. You know, so it's not over yet, folks, but we're getting close. We are getting very close. And don't forget, even though we're getting a little moisture right now, it is still dry out there, folks. And don't forget to get your burn permit through the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection at the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. You can go online. You can do it all online and read the rules there at dnr.alaska.gov/burn, and that'll take you right to that site. Well, folks, we are tickled to have a guest that I love having on the show who is... I'll tell you what, he is, you all know him, it's Dr. Casey Matney from the University of Alaska Extension Center there on K Beach Road, and his son Heath is here with us too, and Heath's 7, and he was here last year with us. So, Casey and Heath, welcome to Growing a Greener Kenai. We're glad you're here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, that is very cool. I'm so glad you guys are here, and... Casey, how'd it go this last winter? Anything exciting going on this last winter at the Extension Center?
So not necessarily specifically right at our office. And if anybody's trying to figure out where we're right below Fish and Game on K Beach Road next to Subway over there. But this last winter, we had the Alaska Agricultural Conference that we had in November. And we filled up the Pikes Conference Center there in Fairbanks up to capacity. So we did pretty well there, and we're looking at trying to grow more farms, and a lot of people start out with gardens, large gardens here in Alaska before they move into farming, so there's always renewed interest every year.
And Casey, what's your opinion on the new Department of Agriculture that Governor Dunleavy wants to, or is setting up?
Sure. Well, my opinion is anything that supports growing agriculture in the state is a good thing. So, and that's the way it's kind of always been with the extension. And so we typically work hand in hand with our Division of Ag Resources that we have right now that are housed in the Department of Natural Resources. And we work a lot with the Alaska Plant Materials Center that's in Palmer. And then also we work with all the other agencies too, like the Farm Service Agency, the Alaska Farm Bureau, and all of those. So, a lot of people have been trying to lobby to get more attention for agriculture. And I think that's mostly what's happening right now, is trying to support agriculture in the state. And I think more of the people, especially associated with the Alaska Farm Bureau, that have more of a political voice. And I think they're seeing that as the best avenue right now for us to improve things in our state.
Right. Do you think the Department of Agriculture, they changed our zone map, what was it, last year, year before last? And it looks like we've got some parts of the state, more south central, southeast, and the peninsula, south central, that looks like it's kind of warmed up a little bit.
Yeah, if you look at what we typically call the USDA hardiness zones.
USDA, yeah.
Yeah, all of those tell us how cold it's going to be for how long during winter. Because what determines survivability for perennial plants each year over the winter is how cold their roots are on their on those plants and for how long. And one of the other things that also impacts that is the relative moisture that's in the soil when it freezes. So roots that are inundated with lots of rain and then freeze solid in ice, that crystallization of the ice around the roots is not good for them. But if it's right. just moist soil and then they get nice snow cover, it insulates them, keeps them in a constant temperature. So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this last year we did not get a lot of snow that hung around. We got storms, it melted, and then we got periods of rain far earlier than we normally get. But it happens every once in a while. There was sure. a few years ago where we got quite a bit of rain in the winter too. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens this year. Some plants are going to start trying to grow early. And then we might end up having more pests coming back this year earlier on too, because it wasn't as hard of a winter on those insect pests that we have in the garden. So.
Sure. I know at our house, our the rhubarb's up already, and some of our perennials are coming up. It looks like some of the jonquils maybe, and crocuses. And now, is it crocus or croci?
I think if you're, you know, depending on what you're saying, if it's plural, then the double I or the I will come into to play. So if you're saying cactus, it's singular. If you're saying cacti, it's more than one.
It's one because I always yeah. say that. I say, is it crocuses or is it croci?
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, I got to tell you, I was outside checking my beds, my outdoor beds here the other day, and I, you know, kind of started cleaning some of the old organic plant material that's left on top, and I started digging down, and I've still only got about maybe 3 or 4 inches of loose soil, and you go down and it's frozen solid still.
Yeah,
absolutely frozen.
Yeah, if you look across the garden, if you've had for some reason you had cardboard or a piece of wood that was left in the garden underneath that cover, it's ice very near the surface, but in the areas that are open to the sun, yeah, you've got right. maybe 3 inches that has been thawed out so far. If you're in Homer, you're a little luckier. It's a little deeper, but as soon as you get up on the bluff and come our way, it's about the same across where you've only got about 2 to 3 inches that's kind of yeah. thawed up.
So, you know, I've heard some people say they've done this before, but I've never tried it. Would some people plant carrots in the fall? In the winter, waiting for them to sprout in the spring. Does that ice down deep like that? I mean, it's going to be a while before that soil gets warm enough to germinate, but does that work down here in South Central?
So some people talk about fall seeding or winter sowing seed. It is possible, but really what's happening is you're taking a good seed and putting out in an environment where you're going to have some loss. There's going to be loss from predation. Maybe a rodent's going to eat some, a bird's going to eat some seed. But if it's in the soil proper, fungi and other things acting on that soil before it actually emerges and germinates in the spring can cause some loss. So typically what I recommend is when the soil temperatures are above 40 to 42 degrees, that's the time that you can start really considering planting root crops, because our problem is it's just the soil doesn't get warm enough soon enough. So even if I went outside and planted some seeds now, the soil is still getting close to freezing every night or freezing every sure. night. And even if I, you know, did it now, try and get a jump on the season, nothing's really going to happen. So look for the soil temperatures to hit about 42 degrees before you really start worrying about planting your seeds.
And one of the things I use that I always recommend people use, I've got a soil thermometer. Just to kind of double check and see what's going on there, because it doesn't make sense to, like I said, you're looking at potential losses, seed rotting, everything like that. And I don't have I think they make a digital one now, and but I've got the regular dial one, you know, and I also use it. It's a compost thermometer. I stick it in my compost pile, check the temperature of that too. So
sure,
I think it's about 15 inches long or something like that, so you can get down deep. Now, one of the things I tried, and I just turned it on yesterday, I want to see how it works, is the beds in my greenhouse, they're thawed now. You know, we've had enough sun, and I mean, it was 85 degrees in my greenhouse the other day, a little bit of sun we've had. And I stuck my soil thermometer down, and it's still down deep, though it's still about 40 degrees deep soil temp. And then, you know, you work your hand down in there and you can tell it's cold down there still. Well, on one of my beds a number of years back, I put some of that waterline thaw wire down, and I've got it crisscrossed all through. So I just turned it on last night, and here this afternoon when I get home, I'm going to double check and see if that's done any good and warm that soil up down deep. Have you ever tried anything like that?
Yeah, so definitely. And so people have used the heating coils, yeah, the heating coil lines, for quite a while. And it usually only takes a day or two to really start warming up that soil down there. And you can get ones that have an external thermostat or ones that have a thermostat on the end of the coil. And once temperature starts to drop, then they start heating up. So that's a good way to get your soils up above that 40 to 50 degree range where they can start growing. So yeah, that's definitely a way, because when even in a greenhouse at night, unless you're doing ambient heating in there with like propane or natural gas, et cetera, it's going to freeze almost every night. I mean, some nights now, if it's getting under 30 outside, then it might not be freezing on the inside, but it's getting close. So it takes quite a while for anything that's frozen hard to warm up. And if you've got benches or platform beds inside your greenhouse, those warm up a lot sooner,
sure,
than if you have raised beds in your greenhouse that are touching the ground, or if you're farm like in a high tunnel where you're actually growing in the soil.
Sure. And one of the things I've done each year, one of my raised beds in there, it's sitting on top of three flat black planted barrels, and just day before yesterday I filled those up to start letting that sun warm that water up, because, I mean, well water, it's colder and I'll get out anyway. But I've done that for years, and you can kind of tell a difference in when it warms up, the radiant heat, keeping the greenhouse just a little bit warmer than the ambient temperature outdoors.
Yeah, and some people will take a gallon milk jugs.
Sure.
Orange juice bottles, 2-liter bottles, fill them up with water, and then they'll put that all on the interior edge of their tunnels or their greenhouse. Sure. And that does definitely help. And putting barrels in there with water in it will do the same thing. It radiates heat all through the night back into the environment.
Yeah, so. And I've got another barrel that I put just to keep the rust out of the water, but I do a double. The big black plastic trash bags in there, I double them up and I fill it up, and then through time it warms that water up, and I use a lot of that water to water my more temperature sensitive plants like my tomatoes with that warmer water. And that has worked for a lot of years for me.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you have a long enough garden hose, depending on how far away you're getting your water, when the sun's out, that's heating up your water in your hose too. So you get about another, you know, a minute or two of discharge before it actually gets cold.
Two black hoses in my garden, and I'll fire those up. And I'll tell you what, the water in there gets dang near hot enough. You can't let it hit your hand. It's hot. It gets hot. That's for sure. And I know I've thought about this year, you know, it's tough to grow corn up here. And I've thought about doing the heat tape in the soil in my greenhouse where I grow my corn to see if that helps at all.
Sure, and that would help early on, because the critical part for temperature for corn early on is their roots.
Right.
They can handle the little bit cooler air temperatures, but you know, they typically plant corn in the Midwest and stuff starting in May.
Right.
That's when the soils get warm enough over there. But ideally, you'd like to have your temperature up in above 50, in the mid 50s to start corn. So now's about the same right time to start corn in cups if you want to plant it into a high tunnel or a low tunnel outside. So yeah, this is usually about April 15th is when we start planting.
Yeah, and I typically pre-sprout my corn and get it going enough. And Heath, you doing okay over there, buddy?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you thirsty? I think we got a young man that's thirsty. Well, let me tell you something real quick. Even while we're on the air, if you go out that door and go over there where you came in and go in that far corner over there, there are some cans of water. And you can get you a can if you want to go get you one, pal. It's up to you, but you're welcome to go get you one.
Okay, I'm
going to
get me.
Okay. Okay, buddy. All
right. Good luck. We'll see you tonight.
Yeah. Well, good luck, pal. Well, folks, one of the things I want to tell you is the Extension Center has, oh my gosh, it has so much great information. And if you folks don't mind, I'm going to play something for you that I received here a while back. And I'm going to turn it up as far as it'll go so you can hear it. But I want you to listen to this. We'll see if it's coming out.
Good afternoon, Larry. This is Casey Matney with the Cooperative Extension Service here on the Kenai Peninsula. And I have one soil test pulled up here for you, and this is for your greenhouse. You had a cation exchange capacity of 25. Anything above 5 is considered adequate, so you're doing fine. Your soil pH was 5.5, and ideally we'd like that to have that around 6.5. So I'm going to recommend 2.1 pounds of lime per 100 square feet of bed. And that should pull your pH up into the mid-6s. Organic matter's at 36, and that's nice and high. No reason to add any more organic matter. You're doing great. And again, the minimum amount needed is just 7%, so you're doing well there. Looking at all of your macronutrients, you're actually doing well for most all of these.
All right, folks, I played that because that's the kind of service that you get out of the Extension Center. So what I did is I took some soil samples this last winter, sent it to Brookside Labs, and they, you know, it's so fast now, they email you information. Well, I sent that to Casey, and that little recording, it was about 2.5 minutes long. I didn't want to play the entire thing, but Casey went through that whole thing for me, sent me the email with it, and he told me exactly what I needed to do with the soil in my greenhouse. And that was wonderful, Casey. And I don't know if a lot of people realize that that's a service that you will provide to folks.
Well, there's a few people out there that know it exists,
right?
Because I do hundreds from all across the state each year. And then, so I'll do that as an individual basis for folks. I put together a PDF that they can print off at home and send it by email. And then I record a video that shows with my little mouse clicker pointer from my computer going through each one of the items, because it's nearly impossible to explain a soil test and what you need to do with it over the phone.
Right.
And it can take an hour to do it in person with pen and paper to go over it. But when you go through it like that, and then I also attach another hour long video that takes you to YouTube that explains what the soil tests are and what each one of those different units that you measure relate to for your garden and why it matters. So, but yeah, I do that a lot. And we also have an online calculator that I've made. So if you didn't want to have to worry about sending anything to me, you can just take your soil test results, type it in online, and it's an online spreadsheet that automatically populates with what you need to know. And it tells you how much fertilizer you would need to use.
Right. And I got to tell you, folks, I thought that was so cool. It was about 2.5 minutes. And like Casey said, the soil results were on my screen and his mouse pointer went to everything. And for me, he said that everything I had in there was looking pretty good, except my nitrogen's high and my pH was a little low. So he gave me the exact requirements of what I need to do. 2.1 pounds for 100 square feet for the soil. But one of the things that he told me is since my nitrogen's high, and I've done this already, Casey, I've been hooking my water up and then, you know, disconnecting it at night because of cold. But I've been flooding those beds to wash some of that nitrogen down and out of the soil. And it's, I obviously don't know if it's worked yet, but it definitely is. I've got them saturated. And what I thought about doing now is I'll do them again and then add a little bit of that lime and mix it in.
Yeah, well, doing over irrigation like that definitely does pull the nitrogen out of your soil. And in fact, some of the basis for that is if you go to the Intermountain West or the Midwest, where they apply a lot of fertilizer.
Yeah.
When they get rainfall, it actually trickles down and leaches down into the groundwater.
Right.
And so people have nitrogen problems in their well water in their homes, and it can cause health issues.
Well, that's the nitrate yeah. problems that makes in well water.
Yeah. And so we don't have to worry about that on a local level, but when you've got thousands of acres of that stuff sure. all around your home, then it sure. can cause an issue.
And I think what a lot of folks don't realize either is, like I said, out in the Midwest, the Great Plains, the Oglala Aquifer and stuff in there, that after a little while even, they start building up that well water that they're watering big farms with, sodium starts to build up in the soil.
Exactly. Yeah, and we get sodium here on the peninsula quite a bit. There's only two scenarios where you end up usually with high salts and sodium. Is one, you're using a ton of kelp meal or something that's like ocean types right. of amendments, and you use that every year. Or you have a high tunnel, and you've been in that high tunnel for over 5 years where you've been applying fertilizer. Because what happens in a high tunnel is you're basically moving to almost a California environment of lots of evaporation on the inside. Right. So even though you're applying irrigation, all that evaporation happening inside your high tunnel is pulling all the salts, all the sodium back to the soil surface.
Right.
And then it doesn't go away unless you have times when you take the plastic off your high tunnel and you allow natural rainfall and snowfall to melt and pull that salt down and leach it down into the deep soil and move it away from your plants. But otherwise, yeah, it builds up over time.
Sure, and from what I understand, it'll even get kind of a sodium crust on the soil surface.
You absolutely could. You really see this in places like on Kodiak where people have used what they call beach peat, where they've taken all of the kelp and spruce needles and little oyster shells, musk shells, and they've just put it all together and then they add that directly to their garden. Well, if they didn't really wash it very well, they're adding salt directly.
Right.
And you end up in some cases where it's too salty to grow anything. So you just got to be aware of that and be cautious.
Sure. And I've gathered some beach kelp here before. And that's one thing, too, that folks, if you would by chance do that, like down on the Kenai, getting toward Nanilchik and Homer in that area, actually, they prefer you to get a permit to do that and let them know how much you've actually taken. And you can get that, if I remember, you can get that permit. You can get up to 2 5-gallon buckets a day without a permit. But if you're going to really harvest it, I think you go through a fish and game office down in Homer and get a permit to do more, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and there's definitely regulations around that. So don't just take your pickup out on the beach and start loading
up. Loading up. But when I used it, that's what I did. I mean, I let it set for a while, let it sit in the rain. I hosed it down and really cleaned it up. And then just laid it on top of the soil and it kind of started to dry out and then kind of tilled it in. And that seemed to work okay.
Yeah, in the areas along the coastal communities of Alaska, they've done that for years, and what they actually will do is they'll just work that a little bit into the soil, and they'll start their plants from transplants, and they'll plant their lettuce and their other plants directly into that, and then that slowly breaks down. And while it's not producing the same amount as if you were adding a bunch of like blood meal or fish fertilizer, et cetera, to your garden, it you can still grow. So it's a really good source of organic matter. But once you get your organic matter up really high, like above 20%, there really isn't a huge advantage at all to adding more and more organic matter. You've pretty much done it. So it's better to use that material somewhere else where the soil hasn't been built up so much, or to just minimally apply the fertilizer you need.
Sure. And that's what you told me with my result was my organic matter was 36%. So I'm good there. And I one thing I did forget to mention, you said my sodium level was a little high. But so hopefully this saturating the beds and letting them drain down have taken some of that sodium out too.
Yep, they should.
Yeah, and I know one of the things we did a couple of years ago was we had a new water softener put in the house, but we had the plumbers fix the hose bibs and water that wasn't going to, you know, in the house off the softener. So we don't have any softened water actually going out into the garden or the hose bibs or anything like that, which I thought, you know, and I don't know if it's that big a deal, but hey, it's like you say, sodium, it starts to build up after a while.
Yeah, it can. And typically the way the water softener works is it charges the canister. so that it can pull out calcium ions, and it can pull out other things too from inside your water. And then when you usually water softeners run a discharge cycle at night, right. And then that will go into your plumbing in your house. So it doesn't necessarily building up the soil with a lot of salt from your right. water softener, because if that was the case, we'd all probably be getting sick because we'd be drinking so much sodium.
So much
in
sodium,
our water.
Right. Right. So. Well, right. Yeah, you're right. It's a cation exchange, and that's why they use the salt regeneration chambers. You know, but a lot of people don't realize, and I used to be an old water guy many years ago, and they don't realize that, you know, it is kind of weird when you're taking a shower or something and you almost feel oily. Well, that's actually the feel of clean skin. Whenever you get that squeaky clean, that's actually a soap scum that's left on your body, you know. So that greasy, slimy feeling is actually clean compared to non-softened water.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of our water out here, it's all going to have a little bit of hardness to
right.
it. And hopefully you don't have a lot of iron in it either, so you got to put your filters on and
yeah.
take care of
yeah.
that.
And then we've got just a little bit of, we've got an arsenic filter on ours too. We've got arsenic problems up here, and it doesn't really hurt anything. It's more of a just like the nitrates and nitrites. It's more of an issue for infants. You know, as an adult, it's not really gonna minor level, but infants are the ones that need a little bit cleaner water. Like I said, the nitrates, nitrites, and arsenic.
Yeah, and for most of your shallow water wells, you don't have a lot of arsenic, but it's any of them that are like 100 feet deep or deeper,
yeah.
you start to maybe have arsenic in it, and not all of them do. But then also, it's a good idea to have a reverse osmosis, because yeah. if there's, you know, like if you were ever worried about lead, arsenic is also a metal as well,
right.
so it will help pull some of that out, so...
Yeah, and we've got a little RO unit at our house, but it only... the whole system, it only goes to our little unit on the sink that
yes.
you fill the teapot with and that kind of stuff. Yeah. All right, well, Casey, and you got a little garden helper with you here with Heath. What's going to be the first thing you do to get going for your garden this year?
Well, for us, for the garden, we've got to go out, and I've got some little, they're not necessarily greenhouses. They're not big enough you call high tunnels. So what they do in the rest of the world, they call them poly tunnels because
right.
they're plastic little tunnels. And we've got our strawberry beds in there. And so what I'll be doing is going through there, and since we had such a mild year, I'm going to see if my annual strawberries that can be perennials other places,
sure.
see if they survived our winter. So we're going to clean up those beds and see if they can come in. And then once we get those cleaned up, we'll probably move back outside. And typically what I do is I use solar mulch on top of my raised rows to help increase soil temperature. So I'll be looking into seeing how much of that I can reuse again this year and just plant directly back into. And so I put that also around my rhubarb last year to give them extra start. And so I'll be removing it this year because they won't need it.
Sure. I know one of the things I like to do, and I'm just getting ready to do it, is get clear plastic on my raised beds outdoors. And, you know, there's been, I've had conversations with folks before. They say that, oh, no, you need black plastic. Black heats up better. But the trouble with black plastic, as you're probably well aware, is that it's got to be in contact with the soil to transfer that heat. The clear plastic makes a mini greenhouse right over the top of your soil.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that'll warm that soil up. And there again, one of the things, how far in advance do you plan a garden, Casey? Do you just know what you like to plant and where you plant it each year? Do you do a lot of crop rotation? Or
so my garden last year, I have an idea of what I planted when I did it last year, but what I'm going to do this year is based on what I planted last year. So I knew last year when I planted all of my broccoli and cauliflower in rows that I was going to move it to a different plant family for the next year. And so that's always what I do, is I move it to a different plant family. And then where I grew potatoes last year, I'm not growing potatoes this year. So I have a de facto planned because I know I'm going to plant everything else in different places. So, but for as far as picking out my varieties for seed and everything, that happens over the winter.
Sure.
So I'll get my seed catalogs from Johnny Seeds, West Coast Seeds, Fedco Seeds, Territorial Seeds, all of those larger companies, just to see what's new, because they're typically the ones that have the newer seed.
Yeah.
Varieties come in, the either the new cultivars or hybrids. So.
And I got to tell you, here just in March, my wife and I, we were back in the Midwest, where our family's in Illinois and friends and stuff in Missouri and stuff. And we actually were able to go to Baker Creek Seeds when we were down there. And I tell you what, it was really a pretty amazing place. It's kind of out in the middle of nowhere in south central Missouri, but it was worth the drive back there to see all the seeds that they've got. They've got, I counted like 30 high tunnels where they're producing a lot of their own seed. And it was, I tell you folks, if you get a chance to go down to Baker Creek, and they're all heirloom seeds. Yeah. They don't sell any hybrids at all. It's all heirloom stuff. But I'd recommend if you get a chance to go down there and see what you can see. And it's a pretty neat place to go.
Yeah, and some of those seed companies allow you to go down and check them out different times of the year. Yeah, and for me, the seeds that I really try and look for is that, especially for growing in tunnels or greenhouses, is parthenocarpic seeds, which are typically just a cross between two different types of like tomatoes or cucumbers or squash that don't require fertilization through like a pollinator. So they just produce lots of ripe female fruit. And so for this year, eggplant, tomatoes, there's different tomatoes that come out. Because even though you can grow tomatoes quite well in a greenhouse or a high tunnel, et cetera, they still need to at least be moved around and shake a little bit to cause it. But if you get ones that are parthenocarpic, you don't even have to worry about the wind movement or going out and shaking the tomatoes. So for looking at your highest production and lowest maintenance, those are always the way to go.
Sure. Do you like to plant indeterminate or determinate tomatoes more than anything?
So I have a huge bias here. My favorite tomato plants are the small determinates that you can put in their own little containers.
Right.
And they make basically like their own little shrub tomato. So I really like the gold nuggets and... Yep. I can't remember my other little cherry tomato that grows that way too, but right off the top of my head. But and then what I also, when I grow them that way, once they got tomatoes on it, I'll give them away to people. And then my favorite pepper that grows kind of similar is Tangerine Dream. It's highly productive, but it grows just in a little 18-inch tall plant.
Is it a hot pepper or?
Oh, it's a sweet pepper.
Sweet pepper?
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, Tangerine. Tangerine Dream. You know, and I, you know, one of the things I've been unsure of is a few years back I grew an indeterminate plant, a tomato, that was, it was called Oxheart, red Oxheart tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
The vines grew great. I pruned them and they kept producing. And they made the biggest, nicest tomatoes and they tasted terrible. They had zero taste to them. You know, and I grew tomatoes in the Midwest a lot and was experiencing growing tomatoes. But I'm just curious, is there something in the soil that could have kept them from flavoring up or missing from the soil?
So if you're thinking about types of produce you're going to grow that have like the best flavor, typically those are ones that have a slower growth rate and a not such a super high biomass per short unit time. So if you go to any of our supermarkets, usually the tomatoes that you will buy will say they're a hothouse tomato. And usually those are, they can be indeterminate growth, but not necessarily, but they grow really, really fast. And a lot of those are hydroponically grown, but they're just growing super, super fast. But when we eat our own, yes, grown from soil, there's going to be other metals in different proportions, like copper and zinc and other things like that, but they're going to be growing slowly. And so that's one reason why you might be seeing more flavor in some of our fruits, because they're grown slowly over time. It's not just, boom, I grew really fast. And then the other part is that if you're looking for some of our fruits, if they've got some chilling that happens too, like some cooler, they're exposed to some cooler temperatures once in a while, that can also release more sugars within the fruit and then also make them more tasty. So,
yeah, because my wife and I, we like those sweet, acidic tomatoes.
Yeah.
You know, we like that. Well, one of the things I want to do right now, folks, is I want to thank, I've got a little something to play for you here. And
number of seeds per unit area. Then they'll also talk about the number of days until they germinate and also the number of days until harvest. That's some of the basic information you get on there. Then if you were a commercial grower, you can buy them in like the 10 to 50 pound bags of seed, depending on what you're growing. And they'll have much more limited information, but they'll tell you the seed lot, the percent germination. And then also they'll have traceability and tell you how, if there's any weeds present in that seed. But if you're buying the smaller homegrown packets, you don't have to worry about that. So the other thing that you'll find is there'll be a description and a picture, usually, of what you're going to grow. And so for some reason, you get the end of the season, it does not look at all like the photo on the seed packet,
yeah,
which sometimes can happen. Then there's something you need to go back and reevaluate. But so for the most part, those seed packets are really vital. And for a lot of our seeds, you can keep those seeds for more than 1 year. So yeah, what I tend to do is if I'm going to use a seed packet like that, I open it up from the bottom because the bottom usually opens easier than the top. And then I pour my seeds out, count them out, whatever I'm going to do with them. And then I'll tape it closed or use a glue stick to close it back together. And then I'll stick it in a Ziploc bag that I close about 7/8 to 3/4 of the way because you still want airflow. And then I'll put that in a cool, dark place.
Yeah.
Because those seeds are usually good for a few years. And I just threw away seeds literally on Tuesday night that were like 2019 seeds that had finally passed all the expiration date.
Sure. And I know what I've told folks before too is to, if you do have really old seeds, take some of those seeds, put them on the wet paper towel in the Ziploc and that kind of stuff. Take 10 of them, and if 3 of them germinate, you can assume that you're going to get 30% germination from the rest of those old seeds. And sometimes that's good, but if you depend on what you're growing and how they're spaced out, that's a lot of open space of, on an average, of if you're doing rows or blocks or whatever, you're going to get a lot of non-germination doing it that way. So I'm kind of the same way. I typically keep them for a couple of years and then I'll get rid of them. And we got quite a few from Baker Creek when we were down there, you know, some things that'll should grow up here. Okay. I know. Well, one thing I just popped into my head again, you said you were checking your little polytunnels.
Yes.
Your little tunnels, like for your strawberries. Do you leave the cover on those all winter, or?
I leave the cover on mine for the winter, yeah, so it creates a warm growing environment inside. And then also what happens too is because it's a little warmer in there, all the biological reactions, like the breakdown of organic matter, right, and litter, happens a little more rapidly when it's covered. If I had a large structure, I would take that off each year. But what I do with mine is I don't tack it to wood on the bottom. I bury the plastic into the ground about 6 yep, inches all the way around. And my most recent one is 20 foot long by 7 foot tall inside. And I think it is 10 feet wide. And it only cost me about $150 or something like that.
So
online.
It's obviously tall enough to walk in then.
Yeah, it is. And then I put a few 2x4s on the inside to support the structure under the top.
Yeah.
So under the main center beam.
Yeah.
So that there's no chance that it's coming down in the snow.
Okay, so even if we get winter, and it was pretty mild winter this year, but on an average normal winter for us, by doing that, even leaving that up, and it's extended periods of 20 below, it's on sunny days, it's still getting kind of warm in there.
Well, if it's really cold and the snow and ice is built up around it, and it's ice on the inside, even in the winter when it's 20 degrees outside, sometimes the sun isn't bright enough,
right,
and high enough to really create too much heat. So even when it's 20 degrees outside, I've gone in there and it's not above freezing inside of the little tunnel. When you get into the much larger tunnels, you get into much more larger airspace you're trapping overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And so you retain some more of that heat. So it takes probably until April in the small tunnels to really, like we are now seeing, to actually start warming up.
Yeah, are you, I know it's just about time. There's some seeds that should be started now. And one of the things we did when we went on our trip was I put some things in our garage. I got my leeks going. I got some onions going. And planted them like the day before we left on our trip. And they're doing pretty well. I mean, I got some great leeks, you know, and I'm getting ready to move them out into my... I've told our listeners before, I do a mini greenhouse inside my big greenhouse. Covered in plastic. It's just, you know, one of the plastic shelves from the big box stores. I cover it in plastic, and I put a little heater on the bottom shelf. And then during the day, when we've had the sun, it's just fine. No heater required. I unroll the front, let the sun and the natural warmth get to them. But at night, even when it's 10 degrees, my little heater will still keep it at like 70 or 75 in that little mini greenhouse.
Yes.
And it works. It works great. I prefer to start my own things from seed if I can. As you feel the same way, pretty much.
Yeah, I can. And earlier we talked about seed and you can store it, but if you want the highest rate of success, brand new seed has the highest germination.
Right.
So if you really need success, because old seed may not come up as strong even if it germinates sometimes. But I do start most all of my own seed. Occasionally, I might swing by the Walmart at the end of the season for an outdoor planting just to see if they've got anything left on clearance.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I definitely grow almost everything from seed. And I do it two different ways. I do it in the house under LEDs on top of, and I put the planting trays up on top of my cabinets in my kitchen.
Yeah.
With the lights above that, so it's the warmest spot in the house. Or I will do like you're saying, I'll take an oil-filled radiant electrical heat source, and I will put that in my smaller little greenhouse polytunnel.
Yeah.
To and keep it warm in there. And that's what I've tended to do. I will start everything indoors, and then once they've germinated and they're little seedlings, I'll move them back out into the heated space in the little greenhouse. But I typically don't do that until the latter part of April.
Yeah, and I know what I do too is like I said, with my little greenhouse in the greenhouse, my little starting greenhouse, as the sun starts coming up in the morning and it's going to be a clear day, I'll flip off the breaker in the house that obviously shuts the juice off to the greenhouse. And then as that temperature starts going up in there, then I will typically at about 70 or 75 degrees, I go out and roll up the front of that and let the natural heat. Because if you don't on a sunny day, I don't have anything in there right now, but the other day it was 92 in that little thing. I got my remote thermometer in there, and that was that's too hot.
Yeah, and so there's a few things you can do. You can have a thermostat-controlled ventilation system with a little fan, or if you're running a heat source in there that doesn't shut off automatically at a certain temperature, you can get little thermostats that plug into the socket for the cord to your heater, and then you can programmably shut that off at certain temperatures.
Sure.
Other ones, typically heaters will turn off at like 60 degrees because they're made to just keep things above freezing. But if you're really worried about it, that's one of the good ways to go too.
Yeah, I've got an automatic exhaust fan up on the high part of my greenhouse, and I set it typically to shut off when it gets 80. When it gets 80 in the greenhouse, or it turns on.
Yes.
And then gets below that, it'll shut off. And then depending on the time of year, I will open, we've got regular screen doors on it, you know, and lift the glass up, let a little bit of that cooler air in the bottom, and then cool down the greenhouse a little bit. And, you know, it's really weird. Back in the Midwest, you know, it didn't matter. It'd be 95 or 100 degrees, and everything grew fine. And one of the things you would see back there is everybody with their tomatoes in the garden, there'd be a bunch of stakes there, and everybody put old sheets over those steaks to keep their tomatoes from getting too hot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know, have you had any luck growing tomatoes outdoors? I grew them outdoors. I mean, I got like a Siberian, a cold weather type. And they grew, they flowered. I, you know, hit them with a little electric toothbrush. You see the pollen pop out of them.
Yeah.
But they would not set fruit. And I'm guessing because it was just too cold at night.
So, yeah, they don't like to be cold. So the best way if you want to have some tomatoes in an outdoor setting is to grow them in a container and put them in the warmest place you can. And then if you really for sure want to be outside, you can take some stakes, put around the outside edge of your container, they kind of splay out a little bit, and then put some clear plastic wrap around the outside and create a little bit of a side dome where they will get warmer when we do have nice sunny days, but it'll also help keep the cold wind off of them as well, because tomatoes can start aborting their flowers and fruit in the 50 degree range. And especially if people want to grow cucumbers and stuff too outside, cucumbers are really sensitive to cold. And if it gets below 50 degrees, you're going to have problems setting fruit. So ideally, lowest temperature for either tomatoes or for cucumbers, even for a short period of time, is 60 degrees.
Okay.
You want them above 60 degrees pretty much constantly. And our daytime high a lot of times in the summer is only around 60 degrees.
Right.
So, well, yes, during the hotter portions of the summer and stuff, you can grow some of these things outside. But ideally, somewhere inside in a south-facing window in a container would probably be your best option besides putting it in some type of actual dedicated growing structure.
You okay, Heath?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you get you something to drink, pal?
Yeah.
All right. Good deal. Good deal.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, well, Casey, do you follow any of the recommendations for people, you know, like Jeff Lowenfels, you know, Jeff, you know, everybody knows Jeff Lowenfels up in Anchorage.
Sure.
Do you follow any of his recommendations as far as the time of year to start seeds?
So what I do, so this is a good question, because with the Cooperative Extension Service, we use research-based scientific information for our information. And then what other folks will do is they'll take the information that we've put out there plus their own experience, and then they'll have commentary or what's worked for them. But we only give information based on research-based information. So when we give recommendations, it's based on either a scientific study or one of our own demonstration research trials that we've done in the state.
Okay.
Well, we're completely limited to that. We really don't do that. Our publications that people get are based on research. We're not allowed to just put stuff in there. So.
And when you look at publications, folks, the Extension Center, if you just do a Google search or whatever you like to use, just type in UAF Extension Center publications, and that link will come right there, and you can look everything up. And for some of you folks that might be novice gardeners, if you go to that, there's one that's called 16 Easy Steps to Gardening in Alaska, and that's a document HGA-00134. It gives you a little bit of everything. It's about, oh, let's see, I think it's like 19 pages of the best information you can get. And then another one, HG00031, is the recommended variety list for South Central Alaska. You know, so when you say you're giving your information, Casey, on actual data that you guys gather, do you guys have people that are growing in Homer? Because it's different growing in Homer than it is growing in Palmer. And do you segregate where that data is coming from, that real data?
So for different regions of the state, we have three different recommended variety lists for people for their home gardens. There's Southeast Alaska, and then there's South Central, which covers Anchorage, basically down to Homer and Valdez and other ways. They're pretty close. And then we have the interior. So we try and provide information that's based on your local region. Of course, Alaska is so big.
Right.
You could be in a little community on a hot spring somewhere north of Nome, or you could be somewhere over by the Yukon where nobody, you know, there aren't that many people. So
right.
there's
right.
a lot of differences in climate.
And from what I understand, it gets hot enough in Nome sometimes that like it'll get up to 90 in Nome, that people actually are more success growing tomatoes outdoors in Nome than we do down here.
So the people that are successful growing corn and tomatoes outdoors are like in the interior.
Right.
You can get anywhere interior. You can get that air that stays warm and builds up from day to day. You have the 90s. On the Kenai, you're lucky to ever catch me hardly out there in shorts.
Well, I'm wearing shorts and a t-shirt right now.
Yeah, the last 2 years,
yeah.
last year wasn't as bad as the year before, because the year before we didn't even have fireweed producing flowers all the way. But last year it got warmer. But we were looking at temperatures that hardly ever broke the mid-60s. And definitely didn't hardly get into 70s, whereas a few years back, you got into the 80s. So
sure.
you just never know what you're getting. But, yeah, it's cooler down here with this maritime climate coming off the inland.
Sure, and I'm sure you remember this, and a lot of you gardeners, our friends out there who garden, remember here a couple of years ago in July, we had a pretty good frost in mid-July, you know, and I mean... That's the kind of stuff that, thankfully, we didn't lose anything, but that's the kind of stuff that can kind of hit you.
Yeah, and technically, you can almost get snow at any month of the year where we live. So,
right, and I've read that before, that snow has been documented in 12 months throughout the state of Alaska, even down where we are in July.
Yeah.
Not just up in the mountains. Yeah, that's about half crazy. Well, one of the things, too, that my wife and I love to grow is beans. Do you have a particular type of bean you like, or do you put them in a little polytunnel? Because they need to be warm, too.
Sure. And so I've grown beans in our low tunnels, and they do have pollination requirements, too,
right.
for some of those. So you just need to make sure you follow those. Keith, what's your favorite thing to grow in the garden?
Come on, Heath.
What's your favorite thing to eat out of the garden?
Get your mouth up by that microphone and let us know, pal.
I don't know.
Oh, come on. I bet you do. Beans? Corn?
Yeah, probably cone.
Kale?
Cone.
Corn?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. What kind of corn does Dad grow? Do you know?
No.
Yukon Chief?
What?
So the corn that we grow is, we usually grow a bicolor.
Yep. Like peaches and cream?
Yeah, there's those. There's actually some new ones this year that I might try that have a 65-day maturation
yeah.
instead of the 70. So, but yes, so we've done like Trinity bicolor. And then we've done Yukon Chief. We've done some of the others out there. I think Heath's favorite. What's the red thing that you like to pick directly out of the garden and eat?
Maybe radishes? Cherry tomatoes?
Has little seeds on the outside.
Oh, strawberries.
Strawberries.
Yeah,
those are about the best, aren't they? You know, I got to tell you, Heath, when I grew my strawberries... My neighbors, when she was about four, little Tuli would come over to the house, and the other kids, you know, Adela, Miriam, and Harvey, and they'd pick strawberries.
Yeah.
And they liked picking them so much, they thought they could pick them three times a day. And I had to tell them, you got to let them ripen up. And then it was really funny because they wanted to take them all home. And I go, no, it doesn't work that way. I get some of them.
Yeah.
They're in my garden. So that's one of the things we like to do is have the neighbor kids come over and help us pick things and work in the garden a little bit. And they are absolutely great at picking peas. Oh, yeah, they've just done a wonderful job helping us in the garden over the years. And they really like to help with potatoes. Now, I think the older girls, they're getting a little bit older, but the young couple younger ones. And I've told listeners before, I think you too, Casey, is I grew all my potatoes in containers. And it's worked great over the years, just worked fantastic. And I keep them outside of my garden proper because the moose don't like them. They leave them alone, so I don't use the high-priced real estate to grow potatoes. They're outside. And then I grow, if I'm going to grow garlic or onions, I keep them outside the garden proper also, because moose leave them alone.
Yeah. Yeah. One experiment I did this last year is I tried to grow some of our potatoes under the solar mulch, the plastic.
Oh, yeah.
Right on the soil.
Oh, yeah.
Worked great for growing really nice, good-sized potatoes, but what ends up happening is the slugs hang out underneath that, and they love to eat potatoes. But when you're just growing them in soil normally, you don't have that issue because that plastic holds moisture, and they like protection and moisture. So I had to throw probably 33% of my potatoes out because they were all gnawed up by the slugs.
Oh, man. So were you putting them on the ground? Were you putting straw over the top of them at all, or just...
No, so I planted my potatoes. I cut holes where I planted my potatoes at, and then there was just the solar mulch all around.
Oh, okay, I got you.
Potatoes to keep the soil warm.
Yeah.
But, the slugs grew up in there and hung out. They never had to leave. And so, yeah, so there were some really happy slugs.
You know,
I've always
heard, and I know, the folks at Cool Cash Farms, Wayne and Patty Floyd, they've always said they keep ducks around their garden and their farm. And I've always heard that if you got too many slugs, you don't have enough ducks, that they will actually take care of those ducks.
Yep, ducks can do well for out there. If you do have poultry out in the garden, just make sure they're not next to your fresh, raw, eaten produce, because you don't want any duck droppings on your greens.
Yeah. Well, folks, you know, now for the fourth season in a row, that little bit of music there, The Octopus's Garden by the Beatles, that means we've only got about a minute and a half of the show left. Heath, thanks for coming to the show again. I hope you come back again and tell us what you like to garden, will you? Okay, cool. Casey, thank you so much for being here. There's a lot of things to really talk about, but
sure.
The best thing, folks, is if you got any gardening questions, you can go to the Central Peninsula Garden Club Facebook page, ask a question, give them a call at the Extension Center. They've got all the they got some hard copy publications there, and everybody's always willing to help. Everybody wants to see a successful garden happen.
Exactly. Yeah, you can just look up Kenai Extension or call 262-3443 and you get a hold of me.
Yeah. Well, folks, thanks again for being a listener of Growing a Greener Kenai. It's so cool to be back. I can't believe this is the fourth summer, the fourth season we're doing this. And one of the things I did the first couple of years, I used to do a wintertime show. Well, we kind of cut back on those because there just wasn't enough to talk about in the winter. So, We'll be here the first and third Saturday of the month, now through the end of September, which is about the season. And thank you so much for listening. Casey, thank you. Heath, thank you for coming over, and I hope to see you again, buddy. And we'll be back next week, folks. Well, this is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Thanks for listening. It is noon.
You did it, Heath.
I liked it.
Good job, Heath. Good job, pal.